So welcome back. In this session of the class, we're looking at, we've been looking at the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, which is really, I suppose, the core of the original teachings of the Buddha. And, you know, particularly over the last few weeks, we've been looking at the Noble Eightfold Path, which the Buddha presented as the way to the end of suffering. And we've been looking at it in the context of Sangharacitta's book on the Noble Eightfold Path, where he describes it in terms of a path of vision and a path of transformation. So he says that, that you know, what brings us to the spiritual life in the first place is, if you like, a sort of glimpse of a potential of something higher, something more than the mundane material world that we live in. So we have a kind of intimation that more is possible in our lives. And then the path of transformation really talks about how we transform all the different parts of our lives, slowly, slowly, little by little, to bring all the different aspects of our lives somehow into line or into relationship with this spiritual vision. So the Noble Eightfold Path is very much to do with bringing our spiritual ideals into all the various different parts of our lives. And I think so far in the talks we've looked at perfect vision itself, then perfect or right emotion, and now we're looking at perfect or right action. And under perfect or right action is really the whole area of Buddhist ethics, and what makes an action right or wrong. I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. So one of the early Buddhist sutras called the, I better get it right, Upajjhatana Sutta, the Buddha talks about five objects of contemplation. He says that there are five things, well, I'll read it out. There are five facts that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. So that's everybody. Everybody. Everybody needs to. Everybody needs to reflect on these five facts often. What are these five? Firstly, I am subject to aging, have not gone beyond aging. This is the first fact that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. I am subject to illness, have not gone beyond illness. This is the second fact that one should reflect on often. I am subject to death, have not gone beyond death. This is the third fact that should be reflected on often. I will grow different, separate from all that is dear and appealing to me. This is the fourth fact that one should reflect on often. And finally, I am the owner of my actions, or karma, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related through my actions, and have my actions as my arbitrator. Whatever I do for good or evil, to that will I fall heir. This is the fifth fact that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. So I guess, you know, the first four of these, well, in a way, to do with impermanence, aren't they? They're to do with the way that reflecting on impermanence helps us to loosen our attachments, loosen our cravings and attachments to all the different aspects of our lives. It's a reminder that at death, if not before, we'll need to let go of, to use this phrase, all that is dear and appealing to me. And then the fifth one, I'm the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related through my actions, and have my actions as my arbitrator. I guess this is what this is saying is that, you know, at the end of the day, at the end of our lives, what we will be left with is the effect of what we've done in our lives. And I think this final reflection, it has a very particular connotation in the ancient Indian culture in which it was given, because of course at that time there was the idea of the Brahmins, or the hereditary priesthood. So there was an idea that you could be born into a Brahminical family, and by being born into a Brahminical family, you could sort of inherit the right to learning and to become a priest. And in a way, the idea is you could be born holy, you could be born into a holy family. But of course, the Buddha is saying something quite different here. He's saying, I'm the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related through my actions, and have my actions as my arbitrator. So in a way, nobody else is going to say whether we're good or bad. There's no external judge of that. You know, we can't be born good or bad. In a way, we sort of create our ethical nature through what we do. And that's a real sort of core, very sort of characteristic teaching of the Buddha, that you can't be born good, you can't be born into a spiritual path. You have to put yourself onto the spiritual path through what you do. And this is what Bhante Sangharaja draws out as the principle of Buddhist ethics, the principle of karma, that skillful actions lead to happiness and unskillful actions lead to suffering. And as the Buddha said, we need to reflect on this again and again. I would say that even if we only have to know one thing about Buddhism, this is the one thing that is the most important. The most important thing is that we realise and we reflect very often that what leads to happiness is actually whether we act skillfully or not. And skillful actions are actions based on loving kindness, generosity, and an understanding of the interconnected nature of living beings. And unskillful actions are based on the opposite. They're based on craving, aversion, and you could say an ignorant belief in a sort of ego, in a fixed separate selfhood. So that's really the core of the Buddhist approach to ethics. It's not about you know, whether God judges you as being good or bad. It's not about it's not really about anything else. It's about the intention that lies behind our actions. You know, if we act with a positive, skillful intention, then that action will be ethically positive, and that action will lead to happiness and well-being for ourselves and others. And conversely, you know, if we act with a negative intention, if we act from a place of craving, aversion, or hatred, then inevitably that will cause suffering for ourselves and for others. And I think the idea is that this principle of karma is a sort of inherent principle of the universe. It's part of the way things, part of the way things are, part of the way our minds work. And of course, the traditional belief was that our rebirth will be determined by the karma accumulated in our lives. So in this sense, we're heir to our actions, born of our actions. So if we, I'm an ancient Indian Buddhist, would have believed that if you carry out a lot of positive actions in your life, then when you're reborn, you'll be reborn into a positive state, into a beneficial, advantageous rebirth that in a sense is a direct result of the positive actions that you've created in the previous life. But if we can't quite stretch to sort of believing in this, we can still see karma in a sort of ethical, psychological way. So we can see it as something that's operating in our lives, that in a way, our present self and our present sort of field of awareness and experience is actually created out of all the things that we've done in the past. So what we are now is a product of what we've done in the past. And the next thing that we do, our next action, whether it's an action of body, speech, or mind, will to some degree shape the person that we become in future. So in a sense, the future is always under our control to a certain extent. We can shape the person that we become through our actions. And it's important to say that skillful action, this is action based in essentially in wisdom and compassion, is how enlightened consciousness naturally expresses itself. So an enlightened being is naturally and spontaneously ethical. A Buddha doesn't have to think about whether to act ethically or not. You know, a Buddha would just spontaneously and naturally act in an ethical way, responding to whatever the needs of the situation may be. But as an enlightened, unenlightened being, we're not able to act spontaneously ethically. Although we may have moments where we do, actually. But as unenlightened beings, we need to take on training principles. We need to make a deliberate effort to act in particular ways, to act in ways almost as if we're enlightened. Yeah, we have to act as if we're enlightened, even though we're not. Because by doing that, we actually contribute to reforming our own characters. And you could say that the way the principle seems to work is that our actions and intentions gradually form or create a sort of momentum that forms into habits. So if we act generously, that will make it easier for us to act generously the next time, and the next time, and the next time, and eventually almost like a sort of snowball into, you know, a strong habit of generosity, and in a sense make us into a naturally generous person. So our actions and intentions form into habits, which then shape our characters. And interestingly, as I don't know a huge amount about this, but I believe that research into neuroscience seems to point to a kind of basis of this in brain chemistry. That, you know, when you do something, it actually shapes the way the synapses in your brain connect and creates, in a certain way, sort of synaptic pathways in your brain, so that if you do something repeatedly over and over again, it actually does shape your brain in a way that makes it more likely for those thoughts and intentions to link up in that way in the future. Which I think is fascinating, that, you know, neuroscience approaching things from one direction could actually come up with something that's actually very similar to what the ancient Indians came up with through observing their experience. And I think we can often observe this in older people. You know, you do see some old people who radiate love and positivity, who are just very, very positive, and others, you know, who seem quite caught up in anger and negative states. So if we want to be happy in the future, we need to bring attention to and take care of the mental states and the actions that we're cultivating now, because in a way those are, you know, what happened to us in the future. And apparently the Buddha, a lot of people used to come to the Buddha and say to him, because people were very interested in future lives in those days. So people would come to the Buddha and say, you know, well, can you tell me what my life will be in the future, or what my rebirth will be? And the Buddha would sometimes say, well, if you want to know what your rebirth's going to be, look at what you're doing now. Because in a way, your rebirth in the future will just be an extension of what you're doing now. Very interesting. And I suppose the other thing is, the other thing is, we're it says in the original quote, born of our actions, related to our action, related through my actions. I think that's quite interesting, that the way that we behave ethically tends to shape our network of relationships. So, I don't know, if we're a heavy drinker, say, you know, we drink a lot, we go to the pub all the time, we'll tend to accumulate a network of friends and sort of social relations that are based around alcohol. Whereas we come to a Buddhist centre, we'll tend to build up a network of relationships that's based around sort of spiritual practice and spiritual friendship and the cultivation of more positive things. So in a way, the network of relationships that we live in, which in a way sort of creates our world in a certain way, again, is a sort of mirror image of what we're cultivating through our ethical practice. So if we cultivate positive, skillful mental states of generosity, kindness, empathy, we'll tend to end up being surrounded by positive and supportive people. According to the Metta Sutta, even animals will love us. We cultivate lots of metta, even animals will look kindly towards us, and we're less likely to get attacked by dogs. I think there's something in it, actually. I think there is something in it. we've got the in Buddhism, of course, we've got the five precepts and we've got the 10 precepts. I thought I'd talk a little bit about the 10 precepts, which I mean, I guess you'll have come across before, but I'll just sort of outline them, and then maybe we could have some more discussion about where we're at with these in our lives. So the 10 positive precepts are, first of all, with deeds of loving kindness, we purify our bodies. So in a way, loving kindness is the basis of all ethics in Buddhism. So if you're really cultivating loving kindness, and you're really in touch with that all the time, well, you'll tend towards that ethically. So all ethical actions really come out of the kind intention to benefit ourselves and others. And if we're in touch with that, then we're not going to go too far wrong. If you think about it, even you know, in some ways, even things that you might think of as being conventionally unethical, if they're done with a kind intention, they're actually positive, aren't they? And some things that you may think of as being conventionally ethical, if you do them in a kind of mean-spirited way, they're actually not ethical, if you sort of mean. I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example. people are very sort of judgmental about other people's sexual activities, for example. You know, so if you know, very very judgmental about that person, no, they shouldn't be doing that, or they, you know, should be, you know, whatever it might be. That sort of judgmentalism around sort of sex and relationships. You know, people who are sort of expressing that often feel like they're being very kind of moral, aren't they? But actually, people can actually be quite mean in some ways. You know, I'm just sort of grasping, you know, just grasping an example. So, in a way, the basis of this is loving kindness. The basis of ethics is loving kindness. Then secondly, we purify our bodies with open-handed generosity. This is quite an open-handed, open-ended precept. I mean, in a way, we can go on working towards becoming more and more generous, almost indefinitely. And the tradition talks about, you know, being generous in terms of material things, obviously giving money and material help to people, giving our time to people. You know, we can see, well, you know, if we're really busy and we feel under stress and somebody needs us to help with things, you know, we're willing to sort of put down what we're doing and actually respond to what we're being asked. There's an interesting one that talk about being generous with the gift of fearlessness as well. We were talking about this in a discussion group the other day, that inspiring confidence in other people is seen as being an ethical thing in Buddhism, you know, which I think is quite an interesting idea, isn't it? I think we tend to think about confidence in a psychological way. We tend to think, well, you're either confident or you're not. Do you know what I mean? But saying, well, actually, it's an act of generosity to try and help other people become more confident, to overcome the things that they're afraid of. Well, that's very interesting. That's an ethical issue. Thirdly, stillness, simplicity, and contentment, which is the positive counterpart of sexual misconduct. So, you know, it's just trying to be content with whatever situation we're in. If we're in a relationship, to be, you know, have a positive attitude towards that relationship. If we're single, to have a positive attitude towards being single, to see that as a positive thing. And then we have four speech precepts, which kind of reflects the fact that most of us have to work pretty hard at our speech. Truthful speech, truthful communication, kindly and gracious communication. So communication which is sort of pleasant and enjoyable to other people, utterance, communication that's helpful and harmonious, so speech that actually helps people, that helps people move in the right direction, that brings people together, that doesn't sort of divide people or create differences between people. And I was thinking, actually, one of the interesting things about working in a in a Buddhist community, or you know, being in a Buddhist community generally, is actually one of the areas where we can really work on our speech. Actually, and if you're around people who are in a way sort of more experienced than oneself, one can often see how actually they're more conscious about the way that they're using their speech. They're more conscious of how the words that they use are affecting the people around them. It's a very big area for a lot of us. And it's also interesting how, you know, well, certainly in my case, if I get a bit sort of unaware, how I'll often find myself coming out with stuff that afterwards I sort of think, oh no. You know, that's what I mean. Whether it's, you know, actually harmful or just a bit daft, you know. But, you know, we can easily slip into things, you know, just slightly undermining people or saying things that are a little bit diggy or nasty. And in a way, you know, afterwards we look back and we can sort of think, oh no. So yeah, there's a whole big area around practicing positive, skillful speech. And then we have three mind precepts. And the three mind precepts are put as abandoning covetousness for tranquility. So, you know, trying to overcome our tendency to be greedy and grabby and acquisitive. So abandoning covetousness for tranquility. Changing hatred into compassion. So, in a way, acknowledging and working with our own tendency to ill will. I suppose saying English culture is particularly, I don't know, maybe different nations are different, but there can be quite a strong sort of strand of aversion and ill will in the way that people express themselves. I mean, just going around London and listening to the way that people are talking. So changing hatred and compassion. And finally, transforming ignorance into wisdom. So in a way, working with our own tendencies to delusion and misunderstanding, and trying to bring the way that we're thinking about things more and more into line with, you know, the principles of wisdom, that you're seeing the impermanent and interconnected and unsatisfactory nature of all the things around us in our experience. So finally these mind precepts that are to do with, in a way, sort of transforming the roots of our negative actions, you know, following our actions right back to their kind of root in how we're seeing things, how we're interpreting our experience, the kind of views that we have about things. And again, you know, this is a big working ground. I mean, quite often I find that if I find myself acting a bit unskillfully, I can sort of trace it back and I can think, well, what's the basic delusion that's going on there? I mean, like, for example, we were talking today about stress and anxiety. How if you look at stress and anxiety and you see, well, what's going on there? There's often particular views about the nature of self and the nature of experience. There could be a very strong sense that somehow we might be under threat, and that, I don't know, if we don't get a piece of work done in time, people will think badly of us or condemn us or bad things will happen. And this can all be kind of going on behind the surface, if you see what I mean. So it can be very interesting to just sort of keep reflecting on, you know, what are our sort of basic underlying views and how do these views affect how we act and how we are in relation to people. So that was all I wanted to say about perfect action. I mean, so there's a whole huge area, and Amara Pushpa is going to talk more about it next week.